As their continent confronted the forces of European colonization well into the 20th century, like-minded intellectuals from Istanbul to Tokyo developed theories on what they imagined would be the rise and possible dominance of Asia. In his latest book, From the Ruins of Empire, the Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, Pankaj Mishra guides us through this intellectual groundwork. Mr. Mishra's other books include An End to Suffering and Temptations of the West and a novel called The Romantics. This new book is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, thanks.
Japan's destruction of the Russian Navy at the beginning of the 20th century marked the first defeat of a major European power by a non-European country since the Middle Ages. And you say that the Battle of Tsushima was essential to the development of the contemporary world. In what way?
It's the beginning of the history of Asia, of modern Asia.
Because it was taught, I remember hearing about it in high school.
Oh, really?
It was taught as something of a footnote.
Really extraordinary, because it wasn't. It was like this is the moment when Japan defeats a European power and shows all these people who've been sort of feeling themselves humiliated, feeling themselves inferior to Western powers, is that, here is a big, small, little country like Japan defeating Russia, and this can be done, and they can also do it. They can also acquire these secrets of Western power that Japan has acquired and mash the West, and a range of people from Gandhi to Sun Yat-sen to Ataturk in Turkey draw that lesson from this victory.
So did they see it to some degree as revenge of Asia?
Well, quite a lot of people.
Because Japan is the only country that we're talking about that hadn't been colonized.
They hadn't been colonized, and actually a lot of people in Japan saw that as revenge. You know, there were certainly a lot of racial theories there in play, and often as a response to the kind of racialisms that Asian peoples had suffered. In response to the Yellow Peril, there was this idea of the white disaster that a lot of Japanese people talked about.
I'd imagine that it came as a surprise to a lot of people because Japan had just started to modernize during the Meiji period. But had it become the only Asian nation with a military force on a par or superior to a Western country?
The only country around that time. And as you say, very, very quickly, like late 1860s, they start. And by 1895, they're defeating China. I mean, that was the big kind of coming out party for modern Japan. And then 1905, Russia. And then, we know the rest of that story in the 20th century, defeating European imperialisms across Asia, basically destroying European power in Asia. So,
and imposing Asian imperialism.
Indeed.
In its way.
Which Tagore then critiques very brilliantly early on.
Well, how did the Europeans react to the defeat of Russia?
Well, they were very concerned that this was the beginning of something, very, very new and dangerous to their own influence and power over Asia. So they saw it right away that this is going to be, in many ways, a psychological breaking of a barrier, that people are not now going to feel themselves greatly empowered by Japan's example.
You refer to a process of intellectual decolonization. What do you mean by that, and when did it begin?
I think it's part of this process that Japan's victory inaugurated, where people stop feeling themselves inferior to the West and stop thinking of themselves as equal partners of the West and people who could also regain respect and dignity in the international order.
But in the early years of the 20th century in Japan, intellectuals like Nagai Kafu, who had lived in the West for a number of years, were faced with the problem of resolving how Japan could modernize without losing a sense of national identity rooted in hundreds of years of aesthetic traditions. They were obviously had also witnessed what had gone on in other Asian countries.
Well, India was a cautionary tale where you could have an entire cultural tradition under siege, if not actually destroyed, by the superior power of the West. So for a lot of people in China and Japan, this becomes very evident when Tagore goes to China and Japan and is greeted as someone coming from a lost country, as they call India, where you have a country which has really been completely devastated by Western imperialism. So for a lot of Chinese and Japanese, this was a major aim, how to mash the West without losing your cultural traditions.
You refer to non-white people as a distinct group in your book. To what extent did non-white people feel a sense of solidarity in the 20th century, in the beginning of the 20th
century? Partly because there was a sort of shared sense of being humiliated very consistently over a long period of time, because we always forget that imperialism brought with it these very rigid racial hierarchies. So, you know, even Japan, it modernizes, it defeats Russia, and still it faces this problem of racial equality, which becomes a big issue for them in 1919 Paris Peace Conference.
Now, was there a pan-Asianist movement? We're talking about a huge continent, the largest continent, and very different cultures across.
Well, you know, when Japan defeated Russia, there was this idea that Japan was now going to be the leader of this resurgent Asia. And there were a lot of people in Japan who were promoting this idea and inviting people and encouraging them to come to Japan and learn the secrets of Japanese power and patronizing them. And that went through different phases. I mean, there were a lot of very well-intentioned people in Japan who wanted a kind of pan-Asian front against Western power. But eventually that, you know, became a form of Japanese imperialism.
Well, the two great countries that had been colonized had once been really important countries intellectually. China had been the center of the world, at least it saw itself as such for a long time. India and the Muslim countries really had been the intellectual center of the world for as much as China, and the rise of Europe finally challenged the special preeminence, especially the preeminence of Muslims. Before the Middle Ages, Muslims really were the ones who were keeping culture alive in that part of the world.
Culture as well as commerce. I mean, so much of world trade depended on Muslims, on Muslim sailors, on Muslim accountants, on Muslim merchants, on Muslim business innovations. After all, Christopher, Vasco da Gama, when he first got to India, was helped by an Arab sailor from East Africa. So they were really essential to the functioning of world trade and commerce, and thought of themselves in the center of the world.
Did the Western notion of Asia as backwards exist before that time?
Well, you see this dramatic turn in Europe in the sort of early 19th century, because until that point, they're all kind of great Asia files. France has a very strong tradition of what people like Voltaire looking up to countries like China and say, what can we learn from them? Similarly, in Britain and various other parts of Europe, but then with the victories of Western imperialism, this new idea comes in that Asia is inferior, that we have nothing to learn from them whatsoever.
And then Asians started trying to emulate the West during the 19th century.
In order to, that was the imperative, that how do you mash the power of the West? And Japan, again, shows the way. You do that by recreating yourself, reconstituting yourself as a powerful nation state with a strong military, with a proper constitution, with, individual rights guaranteed, at least to a certain extent, to its citizens. So they had to borrow these secrets of Western power in order to match it.
My guest is Pankaj Mishra. His book, From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You focus on three men in particular, Al Afghani, Liang Qichao, and Rabindranath Tagore. Many people will be familiar with the name Tagore, but the other two, less so.
Absolutely. They came as a revelation to me, particularly Jamaluddin Al-Afghani, who was a major Muslim figure in the late 19th century. I mean, he was later known as a godfather of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but he also inaugurated various other political tendencies. I mean, you name it, pan-Islamism, pan-Arabism, Islamic modernism, a whole range of thought and political ideas.
He claimed to be a Sunni and from Afghanistan, but...
He was actually born in Iran.
And he was a Shiite.
Well, in order to have more credibility in the Sunni Muslim countries he traveled through and wanted to influence, he passed himself off as a kind of Sunni Muslim.
And what impact did the mutiny in India have on Al-Afghani?
I think it shaped his thinking to an extraordinary degree, because the suppression of the mutiny which he witnessed was an extremely brutal thing, and it really enrolled the destruction of the Muslim culture and civilization of North India. And he saw that happening, right in front of him, and he took that lesson to other countries he traveled to and warned the Egyptians, for instance, that, you know, these businessmen from the West are soon followed by soldiers. And before you know it, your country will be occupied. And so it was in 1882 by the British.
You call it the Boxer Uprising. In the West, we call it the Boxer Rebellion.
Yes. Well, it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, for a lot of Chinese awakening to the fallen state of their country in the world, you know, here was this completely helpless, pathetic little empire which just about any Western power could come and claim, you know, their little slice of the melon, as it used to be called, the Chinese melon. And, you know, even Italy tried to grab a slice of that melon. It had no, you know, sort of power in that part of the world, but so helpless was China. So it was a huge moment for a lot of Chinese.
The United States wasn't blameless either. Roosevelt had the open China policy, not because he was trying to protect China, but because he wanted to make sure the United States didn't lose out getting its own little piece.
It's a very interesting moment because the Americans are at that point just coming into an awareness that they also had to enter this sort of international scramble for territories and special privileges in places like China and resources. And, you know, America's industrialized itself and is now looking for new resources and markets and territories elsewhere. So, and China, you know, there was this whole fantasy of the big market in China, the 400 million people, customers, just awaiting American goods.
Discussing the ongoing violent protests in the Middle East in your article in the New York Times today, you say that the United States missed the central event of the 20th century, the steady political awakening of peoples who had been exposed for decades to the sharp edges of Western power. Is this book meant as a response to such oversight?
I think partly, definitely, because I felt there's a great deal of incompatibility between the historical memory here and the way we think of the 20th century in the West and the way a lot of people in Asia think about the 20th century. And these memories are deeply, deeply incompatible, leading to a lot of, you know, potential for political conflict, which is something we see now happening.
So Alif Ghani went to India and observed the mutiny, and then he went to Istanbul. What was the state of the Ottoman Empire when he arrived?
Well, being preyed upon by various predatory European powers who were sort of nibbling, you know, bits of pieces of Ottoman territory all over the place. And, you know, it was famously described as a sick man of Europe and artificially kept alive in order to avoid further conflict between European powers there at that time.
And then it made a terrible mistake. It allied itself with Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Exactly. And then in order to partly redeem that mistake, they had to sort of give up their vast territories and reconstitute themselves as a very lean and strong Turkish nation state, which, of course, Atatürk did that.
Mm-hmm. But were they already modernizing?
They had been modernizing, but sort of fitfully, not at all successfully. And, you know, Atatürk could see that the Ottoman Empire itself was far too unwieldy to be turned into a strong nation state. And I think in many ways he did the wise thing by letting go of the Arab territories and saying, well, this is what we're going to concentrate on and this is what we are going to work with.
Now, what was Alif Ghani's position on modernization?
Well, he was ambivalent about it. He obviously didn't live long enough to see the see a Turkish state, a nation state come into being. But he was very interested in learning from the West and learning from Western science, learning from Western styles of education. But at the same time, he wanted, like a lot of other people in Asia, he wanted to maintain some of these social and cultural traditions.
And then he traveled elsewhere in Asia and to North Africa and to Egypt.
He went to Egypt. He went also to Paris. He went to London. He entered into various debates and conversations with European intellectuals.
And did the Europeans consider him their peer?
They were very impressed by him. They thought he was a fascinating fellow they could talk to, who spoke their language, who was very experienced in the affairs of various Muslim countries. Now, they found him utterly fascinating.
And some people said that he was an atheist. Was he an atheist?
Well, he wasn't. There's no evidence that he was a devout Muslim. I mean, for him, I think Islam was a form of political solidarity, was a way of people coming together on the basis of a shared religion. He was not at all fundamentalist or fanatical about religious faith.
What were his views on women's rights?
very progressive. I mean, he kept insisting, he stressed the role of women's education a lot and how important it was for women to be educated, for them to become very productive, self-aware citizens of whatever societies he was addressing.
And he proposed to mitigate increasing European influence on the Ottoman Empire and Egypt. He was suggesting some kind of a pan-Arabic unification.
Well,
is he pre-Ba'ath Party?
Well, he went through, no, I think that would be inaccurate to call him pre-Ba'ath. I think he went through various phases. I mean, you know, depending on whatever political situation prevailed at the time. And one has to remember that it was constantly changing. So he was also formulating different responses in different places. So at one point he was advocating pan-Islamism, and pan-Islamism in Turkey grew as a response to pan-Slavism and pan-Europeanism, you could say. So wherever he went, and in India he was advocating Hindu-Muslim unity and asking Hindus to join this, you know, larger political movement. And in Egypt he was working with Jewish Arabs, he was working with Syrian Christians. So he was not at all a sectarian-minded person in that way.
And what was his relationship with Persia, now Iran?
Well, he was from there originally, and when he went back in 1889, and then he sort of was very instrumental in this very successful uprising in Iran in 1891, which in many ways is a sort of precursor to the Islamic Revolution in the way intellectuals and the clergy and the merchants came together against the Shah.
Although Iran has never been welcomed in the rest of the Muslim world.
Absolutely. But, you know, there was this sort of very strong sense of Iranian identity and a kind of Persian identity, which he then played to when he was in Iran.
You seem to be suggesting that his ideas resonated in the more recent Arab Spring.
He did. I mean, I think the whole idea of bringing the masses into a larger political realm, which is something he began to realize in his later life, that was the most important mission, that he couldn't simply rely upon the elites, the political elites, and certainly he couldn't rely upon these unelected despots, and that the masses had to enter public spaces, which is what has happened in the Arab Spring.
Well, if I were a young Arab intellectual, would I know about Al-Afghani?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, he's been famous around the Muslim world, although people know him in places like Egypt for what he did in Egypt, not for what he did in Iran and not for what he did in Turkey. And that's where I think cosmopolitan histories or global histories become very important, where they show people working in different national contexts and how influential they were across a broad territory.
My guest is Pankaj Mishra. He's the author of An End to Suffering and Temptations of the West, and also a novel called The Romantics. Writes for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times Book Review, The Guardian. And his latest book is called From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Pankaj Mishra is here. His latest book, From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And in this case, the intellectuals are three intellectuals. You could have written about others. But let's talk about the one I never heard of from China, Liang Shijiao. Where was he from?
He, you know, is considered China's foremost modern intellectual for several reasons, because he was, you know, one of the first to recognize and articulate the sense of China's humiliation in the modern international order. The first one to say, look, we've fallen behind, we've got to do something about this, and to then start publishing newspapers, to start publishing books. He was sent into exile. He started a political movement in China. When that didn't work, he had to flee to Japan, where he set himself up with a lot of disciples, and actually had disciples from all across Asia who came to Tokyo at that time to learn from Japan. And he then really became hugely influential also for a whole generation of Chinese thinkers and intellectuals, including a young Mao Zedong who grew up reading Liang Shijiao and learning from him about China's weaknesses.
But he wasn't in Japan at the time that Japan invaded, was he?
He was actually traveling to Beijing in 1895 when Japan defeated China. So that was also a sign, a very clear sign that China, which used to transmit its culture to Japan, was now being defeated by this really very insignificant country, at least in Chinese eyes. So this was also that moment of political awakening for him.
Now, he had a mentor.
Kang Youwei.
Who's also really important.
Hugely important Confucian thinker who kept thinking that a revival of Confucian traditions, if only Confucian traditions could be reconciled to the modern era, if only we could, in some ways hold on to the imperial system in China, continue the monarchy, marry it to certain borrowings from the West. But a tragic figure because, you know, he's one of those people history is leaving far behind, even as he's going around talking about these things.
Well, he's just trying to correct the current situation, make
exactly.
it better. Is that why Liang broke with him?
He did. Liang is obviously exposed to broader intellectual currents, and he's also more informed politically. So he's beginning to realize, you know, he comes to America. That's a very crucial moment in his political awakening. In 1903, and he sees a country which is just expanding itself and, you know, consolidating last 30, 40 years of industrial expansion and also looking at other territories. So he goes back to China really concerned and thinking Confucianism is not going to help us anymore. Not even democracy is going to help us.
Well, a number of people from Asia came to the United States and were both fascinated and horrified.
They were.
They came back and said, we don't want this.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things they were most struck by, and Liang was horrified by the inequalities here, he thought it was amazing that a small percentage of the population had garnered a huge amount, huge proportion of the country's wealth. And people are living in such extreme poverty, even in New York.
But the same was true for China, wasn't it?
Not inequality to that great extent that had existed. This is a kind of post-industrial inequality we're mm-hmm. speaking of here. You didn't really have those kinds of levels in pre-modern, pre-industrial societies.
What led him to be exiled to Japan?
Because he started this political reform movement along with reformist elements within the Qing Empire. And when that failed and it actually backfired spectacularly, a lot of the people who were involved with this were basically sentenced to death. So he had to flee
well, he
China.
Well, he was close to the young emperor.
Exactly.
But the empress dowager.
There was a kind of mini palace coup.
She was horrified of all these democratic ideas.
Exactly.
And then the United States, I forgot to mention, he also saw what was happening to the Chinese in this country, which was particularly awful. Chinese were discriminated against.
They were discriminated against, and they protested a lot. But at the same time, I think Liang could also see that the Chinese communities in places like San Francisco had become far too clannish. They hadn't opened themselves up to democracy, for instance, or to democratic ways. So he took away quite a lot of lessons from here about, you know, how China is to match the power of the West, how China is to become this dignified power in the world.
How do Liang's ideas compare with al-Afghani's?
Well, you know, they're quite similar in certain ways. I mean, they are responding to the same dilemma, which is the fact of Western domination, the fact of Western power, that if you don't formulate an effective, coherent response to it, you will lose your culture, you lose your traditions, and you will lose your territory and your sovereignty very, very quickly.
You dedicate a chapter of your book to the year 1919. Another character?
Hugely important for, again, all kinds of Asian political figures and intellectual figures, because this is the moment when Woodrow Wilson declares his desire to bring self-determination to the small nationalities of the world. And a lot of Asian people think he's talking to them when he's not, actually.
Yeah. Where was he talking
about? Well, he was really talking to Europeans who'd been kind of suffering.
He wanted Yugoslavia to be
exactly
formed.
Exactly. He didn't want to alienate, antagonize his European imperialist friends. He didn't want to make that effort at all.
Pankaj Mishra's book is From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia. The last intellectual you write about is Rabindranath Tagore. Now, I would call him a Bengali writer, or should I call him an Indian writer?
A Bengali writer is more accurate.
What was his family's relationship with British colonial rule?
Well, very interesting relationship, but there were in many ways beneficiaries of British colonial rule. One of the first generation of Indians to be educated, to also make use of the various commercial opportunities that had opened up by British Rail. In fact, one of his ancestors was involved in the opium trade to China, and Tagore was aware of that. But at the same time, he developed this very powerful critique of not just Western imperialism in Asia, but also people who were trying to mimic Western imperialism in Asia, like the Japanese.
Did he see Asia as morally superior?
Well, he, I think, was very careful about these issues. He talked about certain pre-modern ways of being, certain forms of existence, of coexistence, that needn't be disrupted for the sake of an elusive modernization, for the sake of elusive national strength, and he could see the destructive potential of that. So he was quite conservative in certain ways.
And you say he was horrified by what Japan did, because did he see the progress as anything positive? Did he exult in Japan's victory over Russia?
He was very pleased by that because, again, like a lot of people, he'd been humiliated for a very long time. This was a moment of emotional release for him in 1905. But very quickly he turns into a critic of Japanese nationalism because he sees the destructive potential there.
And Japan also invades China.
Japan invades China, goes on to invade Korea. And this is still, we're still a couple of decades away from Japan's invasion of China and then, of course, overrunning so much of mainland Asia. But he could see all that, that was going to happen.
Now, how does he compare with Gandhi? He's living in Bengal. Gandhi is in South Africa for much of this time.
Gandhi is absorbing different kind of lessons, you know, when he's in South Africa, which is very interesting. He was there for a very long time, two decades. And I think there he came up against certain political realities which made him much more of a nationalist than Tagore. I mean, Gandhi was also a critic of nationalism, also a critic of the nation state. But in the end, he was much more of a political activist than Tagore.
Now, Tagore became famous as a poet and writer of novels and short stories and won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Did that give him more clout within India?
It gave him enormous prestige and credibility. You know, he was the first international literary celebrity. So wherever he went, we talk about celebrities today, but he was the first guy to achieve fame as a writer. So he would go to Argentina, there would be packed audiences there. He'd go to San Francisco, New York. When he came, the New York Times would run editorials about him, and he would meet, you know, some of the most influential, powerful people in this country. So he was really, he had a lot of moral power as a writer, and as a poet, as a commentator.
Well, Bengal has been split. Half of it going to India, the other half becoming now Bangladesh. Was he seen as a writer for all Bengalis?
You know, he's the only writer who authored two national anthems of India and of Bangladesh, which tells you how revered he was and is in Bangladesh, even though it's a Muslim-majority country.
Well, what were his positions on this? Because we are, in all cases, we're talking to some degree about religion as a political factor.
Absolutely. Well, but he died before the partition of Bengal, but he would have been, safe to say, would have been horrified by it because he was horrified by the British partition, the proposed partition of Bengal back in 1905. I mean, anything, any kind of sectarian divide, he was very strongly opposed to.
It's my sense that although you say all of these intellectuals had a major impact on what followed, they would all be horrified by the world that they would find today in the regions that they lived
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. I think some of the most cherished ideas were disregarded, were neglected in this rush, and I emphasize the word rush, to become strong nation states and somehow survive in this very dog world of international relations, which was a choice, which was really the sort of option before so many of these countries in China or India or Indonesia, for that matter.
Would they all have been aware of each other?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, they were aware of each other to an extraordinary degree. Tagore was a huge influence of Liang Cixiao. Of course, he was invited to China by Liang Cixiao. He went out there in 1924. He also went out to Cairo. He was invited there by the father of the Egyptian nation, Saad Zaghlul, who, interestingly, was a disciple of Jamaluddin al-Afghani. So there are these really fascinating connections between this first and second generation of Asian intellectuals and writers and leaders.
Well, before we went on the air, I told you that I'd heard of Tagore before I'd read your book, but not the other two. And you said, well, neither had you. So how did you discover these men?
Absolutely true. I mean, just by reading, you know, randomly reading from book to book and staying on the hunt and discovering new facts here and there and then piecing it all together. And, you know, suddenly I could see how influential, how important these people were.
Although, as they say, history is written by the victors. Do you think that's a reason that we aren't as aware of them?
That is unfortunately true, I think. And it's not just true for Western histories, but it's also true for the histories of nation states like India and China, which also exclude people like Tagore, or the Chinese history will not find any place for Tagore. And Indian histories would not find any place for Liang for this moment of cosmopolitan intellectual exchanges across Asia.
And I'm assuming that al-Afghani would be horrified by what's happening in the Muslim world now in reaction to this terrible film that was made in California.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think that kind of fanaticism he, in fact, railed against several times. He talked about obscurantism and the sort of superstition and ignorance of the mullahs. That was something he was constantly talking about.
Now, this is your third work of nonfiction, but you also wrote a novel. What led you to do that?
You know, that's how I started out, and that's what I always wanted to be, a novelist. And, you know, I think at some point I'm going to go back to it because I still find the novel such a sort of capacious form which can accommodate so many different ideas and issues and characters and personalities and situations.
But when you have characters like these, who needs fiction?
Exactly. That's very true.
I guess as you discovered more and more about them and their wanderings, in the case of al-Afghani, well, both of the al-Afghani and your Chinese hero, these became international figures.
Absolutely.
Tagore,
yeah.
You say, also went to South America.
Yeah.
So we have something a lot more than people just sat in their studies and wrote important political treatises.
Exactly. I mean, people also thinking on the run, you know, improvising solutions to problems they were constantly coming up against in different national contexts.
Do you see African and South American figures who had similar impacts on their continent?
Well, you know, this is something that I've been really interested in exploring further, and maybe, you know, that's something I'll do, maybe not a whole book, but certainly an essay or two about how people in Latin America were monitoring what was going on in Asia. And indeed, in this country, there were people deeply, deeply engaged with what was happening in Asia. And Du Bois, actually, is a very good example of someone who was very closely monitoring the situation in Asia all the time.
Pankaj Mishra will be speaking with Ian Baruma at the New School tonight at 7 o'clock. If you're interested, you'll need to RSVP. Go to our show page at WNYC.org for that. The book, From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Ed. It's a pleasure.